take it seriously. And you can only pass it if you're doing the work. You can only pass it. I don't want to get too sidetracked here because we're under the gun for time. Okay. If any feel that a psychiatrist directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us for a while on the firing line, see the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments, and the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel after many years of experience that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up around them. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again, and this is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, spiritual awakening, there is very little hope of his recovery. In my case, there's no hope without a spiritual awakening. Because what is he telling me here? He's telling me, in the doctor's opinion, that there is an effect produced by the food. That food does something for me that people cannot see. Food changes my perception of reality. When I was born, for reasons which I do not understand, I could not look at the world. I looked down at you. I looked up at you. Load me up with enough Reese's peanut butter cups or load me up with enough pizza and I get what I call the click. All of a sudden, I'm sitting at the table and I'm no longer scared of what you're seeing me eating. All of a sudden, I'm sitting at the table and I'm no longer fearing who's coming in the door because for about 35 seconds, I'm right there with you. That click where I can look at you, be part of you. That's what my brain keeps chasing. But what starts happening is food has a very short life as an anesthetic. And that effect becomes harder and harder to achieve. But the cravings become harder and harder. You're going to hear something in OA. If you haven't heard it, you're going to hear it a million times. This is a progressive illness. It gets worse over time, not better. Why is it a progressive illness? What's the nature of the progressivity? The nature of it is, progressivity is not a word. What is the nature of the progress? Sorry about that. And where I came up with that. Okay, what is the nature of it? As I get older and my metabolism starts to slow down, the cravings become harder and harder. The food and the effect of the food becomes less and less. My brain chases it more and more. But the weight starts piling on faster and faster. So it is a progressive illness because what happens is it kills me faster as time goes on. It also talks in there about the effect produced by food. And what it does is it says, when we're not eating, we are restless, irritable, and discontented. Remember in my story this morning, I told you that there were people who said to me, don't eat so much, you'll feel better. Oh, they were right. I felt anger better. I felt fear better. I felt jealousy better. I felt crushes on girls better. I felt like jumping out the window much better. Oh, I felt lots better when I wasn't eating. And as those feelings would burst to the surface inside my soul like a Roman candle, my mind would lock in on the sense of ease and comfort that came instantaneously, at once, he says, by taking a few bites, bites which other people could take with impunity. And what is impunity? They couldn't care less. I cared about nothing else but that cake that they weren't eating, and they had forgotten about that cake the minute they put their fork down. I am abnormal. Bodily, allergy. Mentally, mental twist and obsession. Okay, let's continue and let's get done. We're going to break after the doctor's opinion here. Okay, so on the other hand, strange as it may seem, to those who do not understand, once a psychic change, spiritual awakening, has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed and had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal, "Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me." Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it is often not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Change that in my mind to spiritual awakening. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made very little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I have had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem of, or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests so that the important appointment was not met. What he's telling me there is, once this illness takes hold and I have that craving, nothing else is going to stand in the way of getting my food. When I want food, I'm going to go through you, I'm going to go around you, I'm going to go over you, under you, whatever. I'm getting to that food. I don't care what consequences I may have to face. I will convince myself that I won't have to face them. In other words, I can no longer distinguish between the true and the false. I'm lying to myself and really believing it here. Okay. The classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and is as much detail as outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. Did I skip something? Okay, there are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. There are many people in this room right now. There are many who are not here. There are many who all of us know who died in the food. There's probably not a person in this room that doesn't know someone who's dead from the food. Some of them were wonderful people. Some of them were brilliant. Some of them were wonderful and beautiful in their simplicity. Some of them were whatever. But one thing we do know, food is a murderer. Food is a killer. And it doesn't care who it takes, and it doesn't care what it does to you. It doesn't care that it will drag you through pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. It will do things to you that if I did it to you, they would put me in prison for a long time. Doesn't care. It says in the 12 and 12, it is a rapacious creditor. It doesn't care who it strikes, and it cares not for the cost that it extracts from you. It couldn't care less. Okay, where am I? George? Okay. There is a... thank you. George is like godsend to me because he keeps me on the straight and narrow. Okay, there is a type of man who is unwilling to admit he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There is a type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written. There are many people in this room, and I'm one of them, who believe that if I only lost weight and got down to a quote-unquote normal weight, you'd never eat like that again. And why do we believe that? Number one, we want to, but number two, that's what we're told. Every radio ad, every television ad, and we're going to teach you how to control your eating, and we're going to teach you that once you get down to a normal weight and go to maintenance, then you're going to be able to eat this, and you're going to be able to eat that. Not if you're a compulsive overeater of our type. It's not going to happen. And how many of those commercials say, you can have brownies, and you can have cake? Well, if I had brownies and cake, you'd have to start making them 20, you'd have to start hiring other shifts to make them. Okay. George, okay. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. The phenomenon, as we have suggested, did I skip something? Okay. As we have suggested, maybe the classification of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. And this is where we get into a little controversy here. I believe that I have to be abstinent today. And there are people who, whatever, but I define abstinence for me as being at or approaching a normal body weight. I have to be at or approaching a normal body weight for me to get the spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. If I'm not that, if I'm eating, I'm eating. If I'm in the recovery, I'm in the recovery. If I'm in the food, I'm in the food. And for me, there's no middle ground. Everything I do today, everything I say today, everywhere I go today is pointing me in one of two directions, and there's only two. I'm either moving toward God or I am moving toward the food, and there is no middle ground. It's in the way I drive, the way I speak, the way I do anything. There's no middle ground. Okay. This immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. About 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had been partially recovered from a gastric, hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life, was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted that and believed that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there, all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. When I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and, deciding his situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort. Unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. And that speaks back to the lie that you're told in the commercials, that someday, somehow, you're going to have the ability to resist the urge to overeat. And of course, for us, that is not true. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we called moral psychology, spiritual awakening. And we doubted if even that would have any effect. However, he did become sold on the idea contained in this book. He has not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, and he is as fine a specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. Now, before we break for our break, and we just have like an hour to do Bill's story, because I yak too long during this. What I want to impress upon myself in this, and I'd like to do the best I can to urge you to embrace this, is this. This is a hopeless state of mind and body. Only a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps will alleviate this in me. This is a fatal illness. I am never going to be without the allergy. Medical science cannot cure an allergy. There's probably not too many people that I know that don't have some form of one allergy or another. When I go to my doctor and I have an allergy, I have an allergic reaction to, I have hay fever. And when I go, they give me pills that treat the symptoms, the sneezing and the discomfort that I get when I'm suffering. But there's no pill that the doctor can give me that's going to cure me of my hay fever. They cannot do it. This illness is exactly the same. There are thousands and thousands of infomercials that will give you a Band-Aid to put on the symptom. Food is a symptom of a greater malady. And the malady is my ego, fear, anger, self-seeking, selfishness, and dishonesty. What the spiritual awakening will do is it will still the mental obsession. A little later on, we're going to find out that the main problem of the alcoholic lies within his mind. We're going to find that out. There's nothing that anyone can do about the physical allergy. But do the work in this program, and what we find out is you're no longer restless. You're no longer irritable. You're no longer discontented. Your mind will not any longer lock in on the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by eating the food to make you feel better, because you're already going to feel better. You're going to feel better than the food ever could make you. And instead of having the devastating side effects, you're going to experience the greatest miracles God has brought on this earth. You're going to experience the fellowship, and you're going to experience miracles that you didn't see coming. You're going to see solutions to problems that you never thought you could solve or anyone could solve. God is going to solve them for you. I urge you to join with us and pass the program to our newest people. And I urge you to go and be part of the chain that brings them recovery. And in so doing, it'll save your life. I urge you to do that. Let's take 10 minutes and we'll come back for Bill's story. Not like the sneezing allergy, but the more I eat of them, the more I want. The more I want, the more I eat. That's an allergic reaction. The sneezing part or anything like that, no. When I eat pizza or candy, I can't get enough.
So would it be like sugar or...
Yes.
Abstain from certain
foods? Certain foods in certain amounts. Yes. You'll need a food plan, and you're going to find that there are certain foods you're eating that may be your alcoholic food.
Well, I've been without sugar for nine days.
Good.
But, you know, it's a little confusing in a way, because you don't really hear any, you know, like everyone does different stuff.
I need a nutritionist, and I need that input from a nutritionist when I'm in the direction of a food plan.
Okay.
As far as I know.
I want to tell you. I just missed you.
We'll come back to you after lunch.
And I'm going to cry. I've been sober for 35 years. Okay. But that's a 12-step thing. But the food thing was always like,
also,
you know, and I went to OA, and I didn't go to OA, and I... But my friend, anyway, to deal with is that I haven't ever, I tried how they treated it, and it felt very punitive. Okay, maybe not punitive, but there was punitive. Anyway, to deal with, I hurt myself further. I've had like a million stomach pains, and it's so dangerous for me to eat. It is so dangerous. And I will eat anyway. Okay, so
come to our meetings in your session.
I will. Good. And if at the end of this you can tell me where the meetings are that you are, because I'm more
inclined. I'm at the North Scottsdale Fellowship Club like 6-7 days a week.
Is that at all going to A Place?
Yeah.
Are you an alcoholic?
No.
Okay.
No. I'm not an alcoholic.
So, no, I'm just asking, because I know there's one AA place where there's also OA.
We're in the same place.
Oh, okay.
Same
so
place.
North Scottsdale Fellowship. So I'll get the address from you later. But I was 318 at one point.
Wow.
And the thing that keeps me controlled now is like always pain, always problems, always going back and forth.
Keep coming to our meetings, please. We'll welcome you with open arms.
I'm Linda.
I'm Harlan.
I'm Harlan. Do they make tapes for these meetings?
Yes.
Or CDs?
Yes.
I'm from Evanston.
You where?
I'm from Evanston.
Oh, Evanston, all right.
I went to Beth Emmett and, you know, I learned how to be a good person, but I certainly didn't get any kind of recognition from God. But I had to tell you, I was feeling this thing. Why wasn't he my rabbi?
Oy vey.
I mean, I can hardly tell. It's so moving. But,
I'm glad you're here too. There's way more to it this weekend.
All
right. Do you need to go to the gentleman's room? When you get back, I will ask my question.
All right.
Hi, my name's Whitney. I'm originally from Rockford, and I was in LA in Chicago for 2 years back, 84 to 86. Were you there then?
Yes.
You were?
Yes, I was. I'm born and raised in Chicago.
Yeah, I can tell your accent.
Thank you.
Fun to hear.
Thank you. Thank you.
You know you're doing super well. These people out here are like,
that's right. You probably puke every. All right, we need to start on Bill's story. Otherwise, we're going to have a problem. And I was just informed that, and this is probably bad news for you, that lunch isn't until 12. So I do have a little more breathing room, and that's why I let us kind of stretch our legs a little bit longer during the break. Bill's story is a very important story, and what my objective today is this. I am going to do the very best I can, but you're going to need to help me with an open mind of making it your story, making it into your story, your life. Because when we see the way Bill drank, and we see the two sections of Bill's story, there's two distinct sections. The first 8 pages of Bill's story are about Bill's plunge into alcoholism. They are about his illness taking his life over. The second 8 pages of Bill's story are about how a recovery was effected therefrom by actions which he took, which were brought to him by his friend Ebbie Thatcher. We're gonna talk about that too. But if we look at the way Bill drinks, and we look at the way Bill thinks, and we look at the way Bill acts around food and, or excuse me, liquor, it's me with food. Let's take a look at Bill's story, and in so doing, we are helping work the first 2 steps, which, as we said before, are conclusions of the mind. Okay? War fever ran high in the New England town to which we new young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned, and we were flattered when the first citizens took us to their homes, making us feel heroic. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. I forgot the strong warnings and prejudices of my people concerning drink and time. We sailed for over there. I was very lonely and again returned to alcohol. We landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot, whether he dieth by musket or by pot. Now, when Bill is talking about pot, or when that tombstone is talking about pot, they're not talking about marijuana. They're talking about the way they drank beer in England.
I'm going to have to get up.
The way they drank beer in England at that time. There were pots of pints and quarts. And it was very bad manners to sit and drink. You stood and drank, and that's where the term bar comes from. When we say we're going to a bar, the bar was what they would lean against, and the bar was how they would order. They would order over the bar to the barkeep, and they would stand and drink, and they wouldn't sit down. But the pints and the quarts were pots, and that's where our P's and Q's comes from. When they would get a little drunker, the barkeep would say, watch your pints and quarts. And as that expression came over to the States, that became watch your P's and Q's. And that's where that expression in our language comes from, is this very concept of pints and quarts being pots of beer that they drank. Bill Wilson, who we're talking about here also as an interjection here, is the primary author of the big book. It is my personal belief that God wrote the book, but he used Bill's hand to kind of put the ink on the pages. I also believe that God wrote the book because the man or the human being, Bill Wilson, did not really know enough to write it.
But Bill is the primary writer of the book, and this is his story. And Bill was from a little town called East Dorset, Vermont. He never had much in his life. He was never wealthy. His parents divorced in 1908, which at that time was almost unheard of, 1908. His mother became one of the very first osteopathic surgeons. She went to Boston and studied osteopathic medicine. And Bill's father went out to Western Canada and actually worked in the lumber industry. And Bill was raised by Grandpa Griffith, and he was raised in East Dorset, Vermont, and this is his story. But as I say, as we move into it, I'm hoping that it will become more your story as well, because that's the objective here. Ominous warning, which I failed to heed. 22 and a veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation. My talent for leadership, I imagine, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the utmost assurance. I took a night law course and obtained employment as an investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. Pay attention here, because now we're going to see something that I bet every compulsive overeater has experienced. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We had long talks, and I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophical thought was so derived. Food tackled me at a very early age. Food controlled my life. My illness had me by the back of the scruff of the neck, and it showed me and directed me to what it wanted me to be, and it did with me as the food saw fit. Everything about my life was determined by my illness, and Bill is experiencing that too. Who I could be, where I could go, what I could do, what I could not do. Like, pull that down. We're determined. I don't know if I'm still... What am I doing here? Okay. Oh, you were here. Okay. Okay, good. See, he was here. Where God guides, God provides. Okay. Everything about my life was determined by my defects of character and the food. What's Bill doing? He's lying. What's the first victim of compulsive behavior? The truth. The first thing that's going to go out the window when I am practicing my illness is the truth. I'm going to lie to myself first and then you. Because that shame is going to bind me and I'm going to lie. And then I'm going to have to exercise tremendous amounts of energy because I told her one lie, him another lie, and now they're in the same room with nothing else to talk about but me and where I've been and what I'm doing. And on and on and on. And it's ruminating in my mind. And Bill loved Lois very much. But he was lying to her. He would do anything to get to alcohol. And I would do anything to get to food. Okay? By the time I had completed the course, I knew the law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that one day would turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. Let's not forget that $1,000 in the early 1920s is a heck of a lot of money. If you had a half-decent job at that time, you were probably making $20-$25 a week. So if you could save $1,000, that was a lot of money in those days. Okay? A lot of times we read that and we think, well, what's $1,000? It was a lot. Okay. It went into certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagined that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and management, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I had developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of markets. I discovered many more reasons later on.
We gave up our positions and off we roared on a motorcycle, the sidecar stuffed with tent, blankets, a change of clothes, and three huge volumes of a financial reference service. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had had some success at speculation, so we had a little money, but we once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year. At the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there and the use of a large expense account. The exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year. Now that, again, several thousand dollars is a lot of money at that time, and what was happening in the 1920s is very similar to what we saw happening, not now, but we saw it happening in the 1990s with the internet bust. Just about anything that you would point to and invest in, you could make money. Well, in the 1920s, really and truly, a lot of these people were investing in things, and they didn't even know what the heck they were investing in, but everything was going up. Well, Bill Wilson, he believed that they needed more information with which to make these decisions. And so in an effort to bring that information, he went to his people and he said, let me go to these places and I will gather some information maybe on how the company's doing or what they're working on, you know, research and development, and I'll report back to you, and then we can make more educated decisions. And they said, oh, come on, Wilson, just get back to work. Forget that stuff. Well, Bill, he was cunning, baffling, and powerful, too. And when he got his idea in his head, off they roared on that motorcycle, and you can see pictures of that today if you go into AA Comes of Age or some of these other, on the internet for sure, you see the picture of the two of them going on the motorcycle, going over to these places on the eastern seaboard, and as he gathered that information, and as he brought back that information, they appreciated the value of it. And so now he's making a profit of several thousand dollars for the year. So let's remember that he comes from nothing. He's drinking, he comes from nothing, and even though he's drinking, his life is going up. His life is getting better. He's getting to be the fair-haired boy. He's getting to be successful. Remember he said he proved to the world that he was important too? Now he's actually doing it. A lot of people say it, few actually do it. Let's see where he goes from there, and let's see what happens with his alcoholism. Okay, George, where am I? Okay. For the next few years, fortune through money and applause my way, I had arrived. My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. There was loud talk in the jazz places. Everyone spent in thousands and shattered in millions. Scoffers could stop and be damned. Take note of the next sentence. We're going to refer back to that. I made a host of fair weather friends. There are people who looked at him as the new superstar, just as maybe we would look at an entertainer, or maybe we would look at a sports star, or maybe we would look at a star of industry who had made a lot of money. And we want to rub elbows with that person because maybe some of it will wear off on us. And so these people are hanging around Bill Wilson, and he's got a host of fair weather friends. Let's see where alcohol takes him in just one sentence, okay? Let's see where the alcohol takes him. Okay, my drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. Remember when Dr. Silkworth told us in the last chapter that frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices? People begging you to go on a diet, people begging you to lose weight, it's not going to work. It has to come from within. And when Bill Wilson had the choice of having these friends and not drinking, or not having the friend and hanging around with John Barleycorn or Sara Lee or whatever, he didn't really choose it, but he gravitated to the liquor. And how many of us, how many times have we been amputated from various things in life and kept choosing the food against our will. Now that's a strange thing to say, you're choosing it against your will. You didn't want to be doing it, but there you were. There you were, doing it. Why? Because of a mental obsession to do so. The physical allergy takes over once you've done it. But what's part of that mental obsession? It's lying to you, telling you, just eat the one piece of cake. And when you eat the one piece of cake, tomorrow you'll go back on your diet and you'll be good as opposed to bad. You'll be strong as opposed to weak. It'll all be different in the morning, and it never is. Okay. So I hope that you're starting to see how his story is becoming your story. Okay. My drinking assumed... Okay, sorry. George, where am I? There were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There had been no real infidelity, for loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of those scrapes. Now, I love Bill Wilson, and he is my hero. There's no question about it that I believe that if it wasn't for Bill Wilson, I'd be dead and in the piano case in Chicago. There is a book called As Bill Sees It, and there's another one in Al-Anon called As Lois Remembers. And this is one part where they're not exactly the same. Okay. In 1929, I contracted gall fever. We went at once to the country, my wife to applaud, while I started out to overtake Walter Hagen. Liquor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. I began to be jittery in the morning. Golf permitted drinking every day and every night. Excuse me. It was fun to carom around the exclusive course which had inspired such awe in me as a lad. I acquired the impeccable coat of tan one sees upon the well-to-do. The local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of his till with amused skepticism. Abruptly, in October 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription XYZ32. It had been 52 that morning. I was finished, and so were many friends. The papers reported men jumping to death from the towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. I'm going to refer to that suicidal reference 3 times this morning. He is looking at these people committing suicide, and he thinks them fools. And in Chicago, the highest building in Chicago at that time was the Prudential Building, which was a mere 32 stories. And literally what was happening, I wasn't around then, but my mother and father, my mom told me, they would literally, as this was happening, they would go up to the 32nd floor of the Prudential Building and just jump, because they had lost everything they had ever accumulated in their life, and they took their own lives. And Bill was looking at them doing this and thinking, they're fools. I ain't going to jump. I'm going back to the bar. What did Bill know without knowing it? That the liquor would work. That the liquor would give him that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by drinking, and I get that by eating. That this was something that he could do to make himself feel better. And it would give him what they call liquid courage. What's the liquid courage? It's the effect of the allergy. It's that effect of that allergy that everything's going to be okay. Okay, let's continue. Yes? It is. Okay. Oh, boy. Okay, thanks. No, I'm glad you did that. Thanks. Okay. We got that. Okay, thanks. All right. My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow was another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. Next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. That would be his friend, Dick Johnson. He had plenty of money left and thought I had better go to Canada. By the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No St. Helena for me. But drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time, we stayed broke. How many of us have bobbed to the surface of life? You've been eating. You've been suffering from your eating. Something happens. Maybe several things happen, and you kind of bob up to the surface there. What happens? Food will drag you down. And that is exactly what was happening to Bill Wilson. Can I relate to that? You bet I can.
because no matter how far life would take me up, food would smack me down. And it didn't matter that I didn't want it to. And it didn't matter that I couldn't afford another defeat. And it didn't matter how much I tried to resist the food. It dragged me down. Next morning, We went to live with my wife's parents. I found a job, then lost it as a result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Mercifully, no one could guess that I was to have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. I became an unwelcome hanger-on at brokerage places. Now remember that the world that Bill and Lois lived in, guys, is very different than the world we live in today. The world we live in today, if you say to somebody that I'm a house husband or my wife works and I'm unemployed or what have you, that has kind of a different meaning to it than it did then. In the 1920s, men were expected to make a living. Men were expected to go out and take care of their wives, take care of their families, and for him to be sitting at home drinking, for him to be sitting at home drunk, and her going to the department store to go to work was a disgrace. What exasperated it was, he was somebody for a short period of time who made a lot of money. He had been very successful for a short period of time. And there he was drunk, and he could not, for the life of him, overcome it on his own. He just couldn't. And I can't overcome my illness either. Okay. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. I stopped thinking about food as being an option and sought it every day, despite everything in my being to fight it. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, and often 3 got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s, and I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. This went on endlessly, and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin, followed by 6 bottles of beer, would be required if I were to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, and how many of us have been in the same situation, the world looks like a candy bar, and we can't stop eating it, and we can't get out of the morass of the food, and it says here, nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situations, and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. And when he says there were periods of sobriety that renewed his wife's hope, what was he doing? He's going on a diet. He was going on a diet. How many of us have gotten up on a Monday or a Tuesday or whatever we got up and we said, today we're going to go on a diet? And some of us have lost weight, some more, some less, whatever. And people around us started noticing and they thought, wow, she's really gotten smart. She's losing weight. No, you were hunkering down, white-knuckling it, hanging from the ceiling. Because when you're not eating, you feel terrible. And when they're not eating, they do feel better. But when we're not eating, we feel terrible. And it's the pain of that sobriety, the pain of that abstinence, which drives me back into the food. Because for them, not overeating feels great. And for me, not overeating feels horrible. And it's just painful. Okay. Gradually, things got worse. Not better, worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died, and my wife and father-in-law became ill. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at a low point of 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and the chance vanished. There were a bunch of people in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, that approached Bill Wilson about a business opportunity where they were going to take over a company, and they had offered him the opportunity to profit from the transaction if he would just merely put it together. They asked nothing of him but sobriety. They didn't ask him to put up any money. They knew he didn't have it. But they did say to him, Bill, we've been hearing about your drinking and we're really concerned. And Bill happened at that time to be on one of his diets. Bill happened to be in one of those periods of sobriety. And one of the people had passed around a bottle of Applejack whiskey called the Jersey Lightning. And there wasn't anybody in that room, including Bill, that knew the first thing about alcoholism. And the very first time that it came around, the jug, because this is during Prohibition, Bill turned it down and said, no, I'm not drinking anymore. I'm on a diet. And
when it came around again, as many of us have experienced too, the guy nudges him with his elbow and he says, "Hey, Bill, you can certainly just have one drink. I made this myself. It's called Jersey Lightning." And Bill thought, "Well, I've never had any of this guy's Jersey Lightning. I better have a taste and then I'll just quit." Well, he had a taste of the liquor. He triggered the allergy and he was dead drunk and the chance vanished. What do you think he felt like when he came home to tell Lois that the chance had vanished? Pretty low. Pretty low. Okay. "I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever," going back on his diet. "Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did." He's back on his diet. "Shortly afterward, I came home drunk." Didn't stick to it very long. I bet there are a few people in here that can relate to that too. "There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve," going back on my diet, "I tried again. Some time passed and confidence began to be replaced by cocksuredness. I could laugh at the gin mills now. I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did." And how many of us have been in situations where we just thought to ourselves, "I'm going to have just two cookies"? How many of us have been in those situations where we made deals with ourselves that there was no way we could live up to? Because once those cookies entered our system, they triggered the physical allergy, the craving, placed us beyond human aid, and we ended up clearing off the buffet table with a firm resolution never to eat that way again, and we couldn't stop the onslaught of this illness. And he was in that situation too. He had resolved not to drink. He had resolved not to do it. He went in there to make a telephone call. He had a drink. He triggered the allergy, and he was beating on the bar wondering why they're not bringing me my liquor faster. And how many of us have done that? The rude behavior to waitresses, the rude behavior to people in restaurants and fast food places. Why? Because we couldn't wait. We were impatient. We wanted what we wanted, and we wanted it now, or we wanted everybody dead. And that's exactly what he was doing. And that's exactly what he was doing. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dared cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight, and all night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? The page earlier, he was making fun of people that killed themselves, wasn't he? The page earlier, he had a solution for those suicidal thoughts, and that was liquor. And now he's considering it himself because he says liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. What was happening is the liquor wasn't working anymore. He couldn't get drunk and he couldn't get sober. Okay. George? Oh, not now. Then a mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that. Two bottles and oblivion. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms, for mine endured this agony 2 more years. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. There were flights from city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture were so hellish I feared I would burst through my window, sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor lest I suddenly leap, though his suicidal thoughts are still coming into his head. A doctor came with a heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. This combination soon landed me on the rocks. People feared for my sanity. So did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight. And there may be people saying in there, OA meetings or in your head or my head, well, he was 40 pounds underweight, so I can't relate to that. He was at an abnormal health condition. Being 300 pounds overweight, or being 18 pounds overweight, or being 27 pounds overweight, and continuing to eat and to live in the hell of the illness is as unhealthy as what he is describing. It manifested itself in being underweight for him. In me, it manifested itself in being morbidly obese. In others, it manifests as being anorexia, or bulimia, or both, or exercise bulimia. Whatever the situation is that is personal to the person reading it, we can relate if we open our minds to saying he was unhealthy at 40 pounds underweight. Do I relate to that? You bet I do. You bet I do. I absolutely relate. This is an unhealthy state, and he was experiencing the same type of situation. So it doesn't really matter whether you're overweight, or you're underweight, or you're anorexic, or you're bulimic, or what have you. We are killing ourselves unless we're in recovery, and he was dying. He's about to go into the town's hospital, and he's about to meet Dr. Silkworth. Now, what I'm going to be talking about in Bill's story is nothing short of miracles. You're going to start to see God moving the constellations of the world in place so that we could be here this morning, so that we could be enjoying the 50th birthday of Overeaters Anonymous, so that we could be here together. And I wish almost, and I know I say this a lot, and I hope I can convey this correctly, I wish that you could see what I see. I wish you could see. Some of you are awake, some of you are not. But be that as it may, I'm looking at a room full of compulsive overeaters, and I don't know what you're thinking, but I do know one thing. Not one of you is compulsively overeating at this particular second. And that's a beautiful sight to behold. And this begins with what we're about to read. The beginning of that series of miracles is about to begin, where he says, "My brother-in-law is a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. Under the so-called Belladonna treatment, my brain cleared." Belladonna was a drug much like Valium is. It was used to sort of calm these guys down, kind of fool the body into thinking it had some alcohol in it so that they'd kind of settle down. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill bodily and mentally. Dr. Silkworth is telling Bill what we've already talked about this morning, that there's a physical, bodily, this physical allergy, and mentally, the obsession of the mind, or what he calls the strange mental twist. Is Bill Wilson the first person that Dr. Silkworth told this to or imparted this knowledge to? We don't know. But here's what we do know, and this is the exciting part. Bill Wilson, through a series of lots of different miracles, is going to be the very first human being in the history of the world to act on that information. He's going to take this information of the body and the mind, and he's going to move it forward to us this morning. Let's just see how that happens. Let's just see how that happens. Okay. Understanding myself now. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. It relieved me. Here's the Emancipation Proclamation for me. It's on page 7. I'm about to read it. "It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. I have done things that I'm proud of, done a lot of things I'm not proud of. There's people in this room, that have accomplished things in their professional lives and in their personal lives that are the envy of those around them. I bet that if I sat down and I had a chance to get to know any of you or all of you, I would be astounded at some of the things that you've been able to do. But there's one thing you can't do. Neither can I. You can't stop eating on your own, compulsively. You can't stem the tide of this illness, no matter how accomplished you may be in other areas. The will is amazingly weakened. Why is it that they, people out there, can look at food and think nothing of it? Dr. Silkworth talked about impunity. Impunity. Well, I've never had impunity where food is concerned. I've had desire for it. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. He's back on his diet, isn't he? I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not. For the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This is Bill's second hospitalization in the town's hospital of 3. We're going to learn that Bill is in there 3 times. Okay. Excuse me. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain. Perhaps within a year, she would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. A wet brain is really not a wet brain. When these alcoholics would drink for decades and decades, what would happen is alcohol saps the moisture out of their brain. The brain doesn't regenerate itself, nor does the liver. And that's why these guys wake up and they're thirsty and they're dry. Well, the brain doesn't regenerate itself. And what would happen is when they've sapped enough of that moisture out of the brain, what it really is a dry brain. And these guys can hole up for decades. And the nurse will come in the morning and change their diaper and feed them, and then change their diaper and give them lunch and change their diaper and give them dinner, and their relatives come and cry because they don't recognize them. It's a very deplorable condition. And it's a very deplorable thing. And that's what Dr. Silkworth was telling Lois. And Bill was just coming out of the drugs. And Bill Wilson heard Dr. Silkworth answer a question of Lois's. And Lois says, is there nothing we can do for Bill? Is there no way we can help him? He's so wonderful. He's so smart. And Dr. Silkworth told Lois, no, there's not. There's really nothing we can do. We're either going to have to give him to the undertaker or the asylum, but he is a hopeless alcoholic. Because remember, this was the second time that Bill was hospitalized for his alcoholism, and by that time, Dr. Silkworth had seen enough drunks come through to know that Bill was doomed. And how many of us have been written off, and how many of us have been abandoned as hopeless by our relatives, our friends, what have you, because we just couldn't stop eating. We couldn't, quote unquote, get it. They did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities, of my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was plunged into the dark, joining the endless procession of sots who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in the bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. And I think that there is a time for me and a time for most of us when we just simply throw in the towel and say, okay, I'm going to eat myself to death. And that's just going to be my fate. I can't fight this anymore. I can't do this anymore. And I had given up, and that's where I was for a long time. Quicksand stretched around. Okay, I'm sorry. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. This is the release of the second hospitalization. Fear sobered me for a bit, which means he's back on his diet. Then came the insidious insanity of the first drink, and on Armistice Day 1934, that's November 11th, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. Here's some promises. You don't have to wait for page 83 for promises. Here they are in Bill's story again. To me, I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen with a certain satisfaction. I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober. It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it now that he had been locked up, that he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he had escaped. Now, let's break from the book for just a minute so I can give you a little bit of the background about what is going on here. In 1931, there was a man who brought the message to the man who brought the message to the man, Bill Wilson. This man was, let me go over that again because I'm seeing some eyes rolling back there. Okay, this was the man who carried the message to Bill Wilson's friend, Ebby, and Ebby brought the message of the recovery to Bill. In 1931, there was a very, very wealthy industrialist family named the Hazards, and they had a son named Roland. In 1931, Roland Hazard was a hopeless drunk. He had himself sequestered on an island, he was so wealthy, and for 1 year he remained bone dry. Got off the island and was drunk right away. Roland Hazard wanted to give his family, particularly his mother, a gift of sobriety, of seeing him sober before he died. There were three psychiatrists in the world at that time that were preeminent psychiatrists. One was Dr. Freud. Sigmund Freud, at that time, was the leading psychiatrist in the world, and he went to see Sigmund Freud. Now remember, money was of no object. He went to see Sigmund Freud. Freud could not take him. The second leading psychiatrist in the world at that time was a guy by the name of Dr. Adler. Adler was a student of Freud, a follower of Freud, and Adler couldn't take him either. He went to Europe, and in Sweden he found a doctor who was the third leading psychiatrist, and his name was Carl Jung. And Jung psychoanalyzed Roland Hazard for 1 year. 1 year he psychoanalyzed Roland Hazard. And at the end of the year, he said to Roland, "You are ready to go back home now." Roland went to the shipyard, because at that time air travel wasn't what it is now. You went across the ocean by ship. Roland went to the shipyard and never made it out of the shipyard onto the boat. He was drunk before he got on the boat. He goes back to Dr. Jung, and Dr. Jung told Roland something that all of us at one time or another hear. "I misdiagnosed you, Roland. You are a hopeless drunk. You are an alcoholic, and there is nothing I can do for you." Roland began crying in the office, and he said to Dr. Jung, "Is there nothing? I want to give my family the gift of seeing me sober. Dr. Jung, you must help me. You must help me." And Dr. Jung said something to Roland that was about to change the world. He said to Roland, "In isolated cases, Roland, there are people who have had phenomenon," he called it a phenomenon because he didn't understand it himself, "they have had religious spiritual experiences, but these experiences are impossible to predict and hard to bring about. They just seem to happen." And Roland Hazard had the only thing that he needed, I guess, to get him across the ocean. He had the hope that maybe this would work, but he averted church. He averted that. And he went into what at that time was very popular. It was at the height of its popularity, and it was a bunch of first century people practicing first century Christianity to the very best of their ability, called the Oxford Group. And the Oxford Groupers were not concerned with a treatment for alcoholism. They were not concerned with curing alcoholics or sobering up drunks, what have you. As a matter of fact, they didn't even want the drunks in their midst. The Oxford Groupers wanted to attract upper middle class people and above to be in their midst and to spread the word that they had found the answer. Frank Buckman was an Episcopalian minister. He started it, and Sam Shoemaker was in charge of the cavalry mission in New York City, and Sam Shoemaker was later to become one of Bill Wilson's spiritual advisors. Sam Shoemaker proved to be very important in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and so with us. And Sam Shoemaker was running the cavalry mission in New York City, and there was Roland Hazard getting off the ship, going into the cavalry mission. And Roland is beginning to work the actions of the Oxford Group movement in the 1930s, and he is remaining sober. He meets a friend named Sebra Graves Jr. There's a name you don't hear all the time, Sebra. Sebra Graves Jr. and Roland become very good friends, and Sebra was also an alcoholic, and he was remaining sober by practicing the actions of the Oxford Group movement. And Sebra Graves Jr. and Roland Hazard are working hard, and the Hazards say to Roland, "Why don't you and your friend take a vacation? You've been working really hard lately. Why don't you take a vacation?" And Roland and Sebra Graves put their heads together and say, "Where will we go and when will we go?" And Sebra Graves Jr. says, "I haven't seen my family in a while. Why don't you come up to our house in Vermont? A place called East Dorset." And Sebra Graves and Roland Hazard go on vacation. And had they gone the week before, I'm dead. Had they gone the week after, I'm dead. They happened to be there when something else was happening. God is beginning to work the miracles and put the constellations into the universe that are about to come together so that we could be here this morning and not be eating chocolate cake. There was another guy whose family was very prominent, and his name was Edwin Ebby Thatcher. And his father was the mayor of New York, of Albany, New York. His brother later became the mayor of Albany, New York, too. There's a Thatcher Park in Albany, New York, that is named for their family as well. And Edwin Ebby Thatcher was a drunk, and he had done a lot of childhood drinking with Bill Wilson. We've all had binge buddies, and Bill Wilson and Ebby were binge buddies. And Bill used to say, "If I ever get to be as bad a drunk as that damn Ebby, I'm going to quit drinking." And Ebby used to run around, saying, "If I ever get to be as bad a drunk as that damn Bill, I'm going to quit drinking." And Ebby Thatcher was sent off to East Dorset, Vermont, where they have a summer home. Actually, it's a little outside of East Dorset, but he was sent there because his father was running for re-election in Albany, and Ebby was getting in trouble with the police, and his father said, "You're embarrassing me. Get out of here. Go to the summer home, fix it up. We'll be out in the summer after the elections." And Ebby goes to the summer home, and he drives through a woman's window, through a woman's house. And instead of demonstrating any type of contrition, he says to her, "Hey, Toots, how about a cup of coffee?" The police are called. And Ebby, and there was another incident, too, where he was shooting pigeons with a gun, and the police had come, where he was painting one of the walls. and they landed on the wall, and he started shooting at him with a gun, and this was the second incident. Ebby Thatcher is arrested for driving through the woman's house drunk, and he is brought before the judge. What was Ebby's only real crime? He's an alcoholic, isn't he? And one of the Oxford Group tenets is to give testimony. See if this sounds familiar. The giving testimony is there to share with another person what they have found. They're to tell another person their story and how the Oxford Group helped them. Well, there were two people who happened to be there at that time. One of them was Roland Hazard, and one of them was Seba Graves, Jr. And Roland Hazard and Seba Graves, Jr. heard about Ebby, and they went to the judge, whose name was Seba Graves, Sr. And they petitioned the judge to release Ebby to their care so that Ebby would be brought to the Oxford Movement at the Calvary Mission in New York City in 1934. This would be September of 34. Ebby is remanded to their care by the court, and he is told, you have one of two choices. Do what these men say, because Seba Graves Sr. saw what they were doing for his son, and he liked it. He says, either you do what they say, or you will be remanded back to the Vermont State Insane Asylum for treatment of your alcoholism. Now, Ebby is in the care of Roland and of Seba Graves Jr., and he is in the Oxford Movement, and he is doing the things that the Oxford Movement demands of him, and he too is remaining sober. And in November of 1934, they say to Ebby, it is time for you to give testimony. And he says, I don't want to go give testimony. And they said, well, you're going to give testimony, or you go back to the insane asylum. And he says, you know, I think I'll give some testimony. So he thinks about who is the only person he can go to in New York City that he knows and give testimony and not be embarrassed. And he thinks about Bill. And he calls Bill on the phone. Let's pick it up from where it is. Okay? Rumor had it that he had been committed for alcoholic I skipped the part here. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober. It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he had escaped. Of course he would have dinner, and then I could drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was the time we had chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility. The very thing, an oasis. Drinkers are like that. How many of us have gravitated to friends because they were binge buddies? How many of us have gravitated to friends because they were the ones who didn't call our cards on how much weight we had gained or what we were doing? And that made them our friends. The door opened and he stood there, fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table. He refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what had gotten into the fellow. He wasn't himself. Come, what's this all about? I queried. He looked straight at me, simply but smilingly. He said, I've got religion. I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Oh, yeah, the boy was on fire, all right. But bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gym would last longer than his preaching. But he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men, and we just talked about that, had appeared in court persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. He had come to pass his experience along to me, if I cared to have it. You can't give this to somebody who doesn't want it. If they don't want it, there's not much you can do. I was shocked, but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. We've talked about that a couple of times this morning. I have to be hopeless before I will let this in. While there's any wrong answers in my brain still rattling around, I'm going to choose those before I come to the right answer, and that's OA. I have to be hopeless. I have to be bereft of thought. I have to be out of ideas. My mentors told me, you got to be out of ideas. And they would ask me constantly, are you out of ideas yet, kid? Are you out of ideas yet, kid? Because while I was harboring ideas, there was no way I was going to recover. So that hopeless is a good thing. Okay. George, help me out here. Okay, thanks. He talked for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside. There was that proper temperance pledge I never signed. My grandfather's good-natured contempt of some church folks and their doings. His insistence that the spheres really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen. His fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections welled up from the past. They made me swallow hard. That wartime day in old Winchester Cathedral came back again. I had always believed in a power greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are. For that means blind faith in a strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much of precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in a spirit of the universe who knew neither time nor limitation, but that was as far as I had gone. And one of the things you're going to hear in OA, and one of the things you probably said in OA is, I really struggle with this God thing. And we're seeing that Bill Wilson struggled with it too, that he was no different from us, that he could not or would not, until he was ready, find a solution to that, and we're going to see specifically how that occurred in the story. Okay. With ministers in the world's religions, I parted right there. When they talked of a God personal to me who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated and my mind snapped shut against such a theory. To Christ, I conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him. His moral teaching, most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest, I disregarded. Are we what? We have to go? All right. We will pick this up this afternoon from disregarded, George.